Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
Well, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. And a beautiful Shabbat it is. Last week, I told you I wanted to do a two-part series on a very important subject, and that subject is reassurance, something we all need in life. There are just those moments when you just need to be reassured that the path you've traveled, the road you've taken, the plan you have for your life really is true, and it's real, and it's good, and it's worthy. We all need it, especially when things hit us from an oblique angle that we didn't expect. Then we really need that assurance, right? I want to suggest to you that in the life of walking with God, for us as a Messianic Jewish community, we need reassurance also. We need to know that the path we followed is a worthy path, is a true path. And so we began discussing the subject last week, and I want to continue it today. I'll tell you this. I became a follower of Yeshua 48 years ago, roughly 48 years ago, August 71, so not quite 48 years. I have believed that he's the real deal from that day to this. And I'll tell you truthfully, I have never been disappointed. I examine my presuppositions, the assumptions that I make about Messianic Judaism. That's just a natural thing, and I ask myself, is this really so? Is it really true? And to tell you the truth, and I really, emes, as my dad would say, emes, meaning emet, truth, I've never been disappointed. I have found that this faith is the real deal. And what I want to do today is continue the subject of reassurance and to share with you some of the reasons that I believe that you can have confidence and reassurance, because those moments come when we all need it. I want to continue again with some of the false assumptions that I think that are very common in our society, and I'm not going to go through everything I said last time, but I will want to say, do want to say this. We live in a world of irrational skepticism when it comes to things related to Yeshua, the Bible, the Jewish experience, the text that we have in our scriptures. Almost irrational skepticism. We live in a very skeptical world, and maybe to some extent we can understand that. I mean, aren't we all tired of the endless barrage of clever advertisements on TV, you know, that we should take this drug and that drug and we should get this car and that car. And after a while, you could say to yourself, I don't know. I mean, everyone's trying to hustle me. Everyone is trying to convince me of something. I'm just skeptical about it all. And I think that we have to be careful not to go too far. That the skepticism when it comes to some of the issues that I'll be talking about today is really not warranted. I pointed out last week that, and it seems so obvious in one sense, and we don't live as if it's true oftentimes, get this, there are facts in this world, and you can know them. You go, Rabbi Rich, I kind of knew that. Why are you telling me that? Well, again, because we live at a time when people call it postmodernism, you can describe it any way you want, that everything is so subjective. The idea of a fact, which is not only true for you, but because it's a fact, is true for everyone else, has really come under great attack. But I want to tell you that God has made us with capacity to know truth. We'll never know it exhaustively, completely. You're not going to know everything there is to know about anything. Pick the subject. There's always more to learn. And that doesn't mean that we can't make mistakes along the way. Obviously, that's part of the human experience too. But I want to tell you that God has made us with the capacity to know that certain things are true, and we can land on those things. It's a beginning place that I think is very important to bring up. Now, I want to share with you another fallacy or another wrong way of thinking. One way of pointed out that people doubt that it's possible to know facts, and especially when it comes to religion, they'll go, that's nice, it works for you, but for me, I'm somewhere else. Well, I'm suggesting that it's possible to know facts. You can know true things. You can know true things about God. I doubt you'll be right about everything. I'm sure I'm not. But you can know true things. Well, the second fallacy is this, that ancient people had no use for facts or for thinking logically when it came to their religion. We tend to view ancient people, now you've never said it and you wouldn't say it because it wouldn't seem cool to say, but we tend to think of them as kind of dumb. But it's not true. They were as intelligent as you or I are. They were smart. They may not have been as technologically advanced because of certain things that developed over the hundreds of years and thousands of years, but they were smart, and we know for a fact that people, ancient people, were capable of logical thinking and coming to conclusions as well as we are, and maybe in some ways better. Let me demonstrate this from the passage that we read today in the book of Yochanan, our Besora passage. And I'm just going to take you through a little larger of the context here. It says, at that point, some of the people of Jerusalem began to ask, isn't this the man they're trying to kill? Speaking of Yeshua, right? Well, he's speaking publicly, and they are not saying a word to him. Have the authorities really concluded that he is the Messiah? This is the buzz in the crowd during Sukkot in Jerusalem, right? But we know where this man is from. When the Messiah comes, no one knows where he is from. So you get the kind of back and forth, the dialogue there. I think this, but I don't know, and what's going on? Do our leaders, and, it all strikes me as very realistic, and it makes all kinds of psychological sense that people would think in these terms as they're considering Yeshua. Then Yeshua, still teaching in the temple courts, hearing some of these comments, cries out, yes, you know me, you know where I am from. I am not here on my own authority, but he who sent me is true. You don't know him because I know, but I know him because I am from him, and he sent me. Now, last week we talked about some of the uniqueness of Yeshua, and these kind of comments you don't make unless you're a little, or a liar, but he doesn't fit either of those descriptives. At this, they tried to seize him, but no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. It wasn't that moment yet that God had prepared for him to be arrested and to do the things he needed to do. Now, here's the point I want to make. Listen to this. Listen to this, everybody. Still, many in the crowd believed in him. They said, when the Messiah comes, will he perform more signs than this man? Now, what do we call that? Well, the context isn't Greek philosophy. If it were Greek philosophy, and this is part of the Western tradition, and maybe you learned it when you were a kid, they were reasoning inductively. You ever hear that word, inductive reasoning? It means you start with a lot of particulars, and then you generalize from the particulars to a conclusion. It's as opposed to deductive reasoning. That's something else. But inductive reasoning says, this is so, and this is so, and this is so, and this is so, and this is so. It looks like this must be so. That's inductive reasoning. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're saying, when the Messiah comes, will he perform more signs than this man? In other words, they're looking at these miracles that he does, and they're hearing the reports, and they're seeing people at the Pool of Siloam being healed, and all this great stuff. And they're saying, well, listen, we're not theologians. We don't know. But when you look at all the data points, when you look at all the particulars, it really looks like this guy is the Messiah. Were ancient people uninformed? Were they incapable of logical thought? I don't think so. I think this is plenty logical right here. And it's one of all kinds of examples. They were not unintelligent. They were practical. They were more concerned with survival than abstract philosophical reasoning like you do in Athens, But that doesn't make them unintelligent, and it doesn't make them incapable of thinking deeply and rightly and thinking about truth and coming to truth. Now, I want to talk about some more of the facts about Messiah Yeshua. I'm talking facts. I'm not talking just opinions. I'm not talking about the things you say when you're a religious leader because that's what you're paid to do. No, no, no. I'm talking about the facts. So let's talk about these. Well, we talked last week about Yeshua's uniqueness. I don't want to go back to that particular one, but just to touch on it again. It's been expressed this way. You got three choices with Yeshua. Either he is a liar who made up all these bubba-meisters, these false claims about himself. Most people would not view the person who gave the Western world the highest morality that he was a liar. So that's kind of out the window. Or you have to say he's Meshuggah, crazy, but most people would not predicate that of Yeshua as well. No, it looks like these radical claims came from a person who really made them because he really was the guy. And I don't want to go back. We talked about that last week, so I don't want to get into it too much. And we pointed out last week that it's possible in the Jewish community there's a tendency to view Yeshua as kind of a bit of a souped-up rabbi. He's just a misunderstood Galilean peasant rabbi who people latched onto when they invented all these things about him. No, no, no. He doesn't give us that right. He says things that no one says because he's not like anybody else. Things like, you know, daughter, your sins are forgiven. I mean, that's a rather heavy claim to make for somebody. Abraham rejoiced to see my day. Now there's one for you. Who says that? I mean, you know, it's we talked about these things last week. No, Yeshua does not give us the dubious luxury of just putting him within the framework of a slightly souped-up rabbi, a miracle worker like Honi the circle drawer. No, he's a different kind of guy. There's no one like him. And I'm excited about that. What are some of the other facts that we need to know? Well, I'll give you one. When we read the Besora, that is the books of the New Testament, there is a lot of evidence that's turned up archaeologically to show that the accounts that we read about fit the actual times, and therefore it substantiates the idea that eyewitnesses wrote these things. I'm going to give you a couple of quick examples. First of all, recently, Pool of Siloam. Well, that's a place where in the gospel Yeshua sends a man to wash and he's healed. And archaeologists for a long time couldn't find the Pool of Siloam. And skeptics would say there is no Pool of Siloam. This was just made up by religious people who wanted to make Yeshua look cool. And there we go. But in 2004, in Jerusalem, some sewerage engineers, stumbled upon the steps of a first century ritual pool near the mouth of the Hezekiah's tunnel. By the summer of 2005, archaeologists said it was without doubt the missing Pool of Siloam. There you go. Well, they said it wasn't there, but it is there. Okay? And then they quote this particular scholar, quote, in the plaster of this pool were found coins that established the date of the pool to the years before and after Yeshua. There is little question that this is, in fact, the Pool of Siloam. Don't you think that's neat? Archaeology supports what we say. And that's very, very exciting because it gives us, again, our word for today, the big word, reassurance. We all need it. You got to have your head and your heart going together. Again, I'll talk more about that in a little while. Let me look briefly at another very important thing. It's not archaeological, but it is historical, and it's really important. I want to suggest to you, and it's not just my suggestion, I'm just quoting other people, that the resurrection of Yeshua really happened. Not just religiously, actually, like if you were in a time machine and you went back there, you'd experience it. I want to suggest it's real. Now, again, it's such a huge subject, and we don't have the time to get into it in any depth, but I want to introduce you to this book. It was published in the 1980s by Pinchas Lapid. Pinchas Lapid was a serious Orthodox Jewish scholar, very well-regarded guy, wrote 35 books. He was actually important during the time of the formation of the nation of Israel. And he wrote this book called The Resurrection of Jesus. And I'm just going to read you a little bit of this book, because this is a mainstream Jewish scholar. He's not a Messianic Jew. I don't think he follows his own ideas to the logical conclusion that they deserve. But nonetheless, he believes the resurrection of Yeshua really happened. Let me read to you some of what he says. Lapid's approach, this is actually from the introduction. Lapid's approach is unique among Jewish participants in the dialogue. The dialogue means the Jewish-Christian dialogue, in that he accepts the resurrection of Jesus as a historical event which triggered the Messianic Apostolic Movement, whose members soon came to be called Christians, though still all good-believing Jews. Well, slight thing there. Christians was used more, that term was used more of non-Jewish believers in Antioch and blah, blah. But that's just a little detail. In Lapid's own words, quote, "I accept the resurrection of Easter Sunday not as the invention of the community of disciples, but as an historical event." And he details the details of the argument are now set forth in this book, The Resurrection of Jesus, A Jewish Perspective. Lapid explains his thesis of the historicity of the resurrection in these words. Quote, "I am completely convinced that the 12 from Galilee, who were all farmers and shepherds and fishermen, there was not a single theology professor to be found among them, were really unimpressed by scholarly theologomena, as Karl Bababa and Rudolf Bultmann have said. If they, that is the apostles, through such a concrete historical event as the crucifixion, were so totally in despair and crushed, as all four evangelists report to us, that is in the four Gospels, then no less concrete a historical event was needed in order to bring them out of the deep valley of their despair and within a short time to transform them into a community of salvation rejoicing to the high heavens." Cool quote. A historical event that no one doubts, the crucifixion, sure. But change in his followers could only come about because the resurrection actually happened. Actually, really happened. We're in fact land, not in Bubba Meiser land, not in wishful thinking land, and I think we should be very, very encouraged by that. One last question we have to deal with. What if the book, however, that describes these events, like the resurrection and these other things, what if the book was written so long after the events that the events themselves are shrouded in mystery because the book that was written about them came from so much later? In other words, you can't trust it because it wasn't from the time it purports to be from. What about that? Well, to answer that question, and we've already begun to answer it because of the archaeological data and all that stuff, all the things we've been talking about, but I think it's good for us to compare, just for a few minutes, to compare other ancient literature with the New Testament to see how it stacks up. In other words, when are the events described in this other literature, the Iliad or the work of Pliny the Historian or various books that I'll tell you about? When were they written? How long a gap is it between the writing of the book and the events that are described? Was it hundreds and hundreds of years? So who knows? Like the telephone game, it just, you know, all the events got lost. Is that what it was? When is the earliest manuscript that we've got? Because that's important. See, once the printing press happened, that's another story. Then you have lots of manuscripts and things. But what about handwritten manuscripts? What about Greek manuscripts for the Greek, Koine Greek, that the Gospels were written in? Very common language, one of the common languages in Israel at the time. And how many manuscripts do we have? So let me just give you a couple of these things. So, you know, there's Caesar's Gallic Wars. I never read Caesar's Gallic Wars. I'm sure it's a great book. I never read it. Anyone read it, Gaelic Wars? I'm impressed if you have. But anyhow. All right, so what about, so it describes events about 100 years before Yeshua. But you know when the earliest manuscript we have talking about it is? 1,000 years later. The first manuscript talking about it comes from 1,000 years. You don't have any of those other manuscripts that were copied and copied and copied and copied. And yet no one doubts that Caesar's Gaelic Wars, fine. We know that about that. We're good with that. How many manuscripts are there total for Caesar's Gaelic Wars? In other words, how many handwritten manuscripts? Take a guess. Go for it. You've been listening too much. How many manuscripts? 10 manuscripts. That's it. All right, let's go with a couple more. Then we got Aristotle. Let's move on to something we got. Yeah, everyone knows Aristotle, right? Great philosopher. Well, he describes events happening between 384 and 322 BC. And the earliest manuscript, get this, the earliest manuscript, the very earliest one, nothing between, 1,400 years later. That's a long time. You get that? That's a long time. And how many manuscripts do you have total? That is of the handwritten, not the printing press kind, but the handwritten? 49. It's okay. It's better than Caesar's Gaelic Wars. Okay, let's go a couple more. What's the best attested book in history, with the exception of the New Testament? What's the best one? I'll tell you what it is. It's the Iliad. Did you read the Iliad in high school? Yeah, some of you did. Yeah. I was too busy practicing trombone. I wasn't interested. But anyway, it describes events 900 years before Yeshua. And the earliest manuscript, not bad, 400 years before you. So there's a 400 BC. So there's a 500-year gap. Again, just to be clear, the material is about this. No manuscript, no manuscript, no manuscript for 500 years. Then you get a manuscript. All the others in between were lost. All right? And we do have a fair number of them, though, even though they were from so much later. We got 643. Not bad. Not bad. Now, are you ready? Are you ready? Wait for it. Here it comes. Let's talk about the New Testament. The New Testament was written, the events that are described are in the first century, roughly between the year 50 and 100, give or take, you know, that general frame, the earliest writing, the events that are described, even a little earlier, 30. Okay, what is the earliest manuscript? The earliest manuscript is less than 100 years later. The John Rylands Papyri, discovered in Egypt, less than 100 years. Relatively speaking, a very short time. I mean, there were practically people still alive when that manuscript showed up. And we would assume that those are the other, we know there are other manuscripts before then, many more. Okay, so less than 100 years. Now, you recall, let us review. How many manuscripts did Caesar's Gaelic Wars have? Somebody said it. 10. Right. Does any remember how many Homer had? 643. Not bad. Here's the New Testament, and I've read higher ones than this, but this is somewhat conservative. 5,600 manuscripts, far better than any ancient literature. And what does that mean? It means that when you open that book, you can trust, there we go, you can trust the book. That's the whole point. When you are reading this stuff, you're reading about a real guy. And real people who did real things, some good, some not good. It is not just religious literature that who knows what the facts are. We do know what the facts are. We really, really do. And that's what I'm trying to convey to you this morning. The point we're trying to make is that faith is not irrational. It is not a jump into the dark. And we need reassurance. Because that's the way life is. We need reassurance. Now, unless we want to irrationally doubt any event of antiquity, then you've got to take what's written in the Bible seriously, because you don't have near the attestation of other events. And that's really, really important. And somebody says, well, but there are miracles there. Well, so what? Who's to say that miracles don't happen? That's another whole story for another sermon. I want to draw some conclusions here. If What I've been speaking to you about last week in this is all true. If it is, then knowing about God and Yeshua the Messiah is fabulous beyond words. To know that there is ultimate power mixed with ultimate goodness in the universe is reason to get up and clap and cheer. I feel like doing it right now, but I'll read a little more to you. To enjoy the privilege of having your emotions and affections united with your discriminating mind, I want to tell you, friends, that's a fabulous gift. You don't get that if you're into Scientology or a lot of other things. There is an intellectual solidity. There is a solidity to the case that allows us to know that what our emotions are telling us about him have validity. These are mutually reinforcing dimensions of truth knowing, the intuitive and the rational. And what we're suggesting here is that it all fits really good. To realize that whatever scientists tell us in the future about other sophisticated life forms in the universe, such knowledge would pale in significance to this truth that behind it all is the wise and good Creator who, for reasons known only to himself, has sent his special love to his Jewish people for the good of all humanity. Men of what they find? This is the big news. This is the big truth. Know the facts point to a God who is willing to send a piece of himself, his ultimate representative, Yeshua, to die so that our collective and individual sins could be atoned for, can warm our hearts like no other hope, wish, or thought. And it should, and it must, if we're right about this stuff. To know that our lives together as Messianic Jewish community serve as a living testimony to some of the world's deepest, most important facts is a privilege which should take our breath away. And you thought you were just coming to services. You know what I mean? Again, on the assumption that the things that we're saying are true. So I want to encourage you, Ruach Israel. Be encouraged. The facts invite you to be encouraged on this Shabbat morning. And I say to you, Shabbat Shalom.
Please, O Lord, our God, let the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, let the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. May your descendants and the descendants of your people Israel be those who know your name and study your Torah for Messiah.